Hello and welcome to episode 79 of A Little Bird Told Me, the freelance writing podcast that tells you all the tricks of the trade. You can find us on the web at alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com, where you will find links to subscribe in every conceivable way to make sure that you never miss an episode. I am Philippa Willetts, and today I am doing an interview for you with a fantastic freelancer, and I think you're going to love it. So, without further ado, check it out. And so today, I am doing an interview for the podcast. I am talking to Muridu, who is an international freelancer with years of experience and some really, really interesting points of view to share. And so, Muridu, would you like to start by just introducing yourself a bit and saying a bit about what you do?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. It's really nice to be here.
You're very welcome.
My name is Muridu Kula Ralph, and I've been working from India for the last decade, really. And I started out as a college student, not really enjoying the engineering course that I was doing. So I started looking online for writing opportunities because I always liked, you know, the idea of being a writer. And I'd always thought I'd end up writing a novel or something, but I discovered freelancing, and I discovered that there was a huge opportunity online to write for different countries, to write for different markets. And so I started when I was about 21, and I started writing for small, you know, newspapers and websites. And then in those days, you had like these e-newsletters that were really popular. So they published, you know, full-length articles. Some of them are still around, but a lot of them aren't because it's just changed because of the blogging thing. But that's kind of how I got started. And, you know, I made my first $100 and thought, this is easy. I can do this for a living. The reason I started writing for the US market is because that was the only information available online at the time. And also it seemed like good money for a college student in India.
Of course, yeah.
So I just, you know, started building my clips. And the more I learned, the more, the better I became. And eventually the travel bug bit, because that's what I always wanted to do, is I wanted to write about the world. I want to see the world. And so that's what I started doing. I started traveling. I started traveling around India, and I started specializing in women's stories. So I told a lot of stories about women in rural areas, Indian women. And then I moved to Africa, and then I went to America. And so in the meantime, I started getting clips from the New York Times, Time. I wrote for ABC News for a while. I've written for CNN. So as I grew with my experience and with my travel, I found that more people and more editors were open to my international experience, and because it wasn't something that they were usually getting.
Sure. And I guess, I mean, some of the places you've written for, as you've just mentioned, are seriously impressive. So I guess if an editor sees that you have written for the New York Times, Time magazine, they will immediately have confidence in your skills, I would imagine.
That's true. And I've always said that, you know, writing for the New York Times itself is not going to make you rich because they're not the highest payers.
Yeah.
But that credit really makes a difference. So every time you say Time in the New York Times, that's the only two you need to say, really. You
of
say
course,
those
yeah.
two and people think, okay, she knows what she's doing. You know, if she's been published in the New York Times, which is not necessarily true, you know,
yes.
they're not, you know, as hard to break into as a lot of people seem to think. It's just that they're big names.
Yeah.
And, but those are big names that can really open up the world for you. And in my case, it did. I mean, I'd written for about 5 or 6 years before I broke into the New York Times.
Yeah.
I broke into Time magazine first. However, once I had those two names in my portfolio, absolutely, doors opened, got higher pay, and a lot more confidence from foreign editors, especially as a writer in India. I think it makes a huge difference. I think you need those. I think you need some level of some credibility because
yes.
We know, like, especially now with this whole Indian writers will work for a dollar
yes.
for an article or something.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. But that's the image now. And so if you want to move beyond that, I suppose getting those hard clips in first really makes a difference.
Yeah, I would imagine there are a lot of people who would be intimidated by the idea of even approaching the New York Times. And you know, that caliber, that kind of high-profile publication. And it's easy to forget that they need somebody to write their things.
Yeah, and you know what? I've been there. I did it. Yeah. For many years, I did not pitch them, even though they were on the top of my dream publication list. But I dated a photographer for a while, and he stole my ideas and sold them to the New York Times.
Ouch.
And when I opened up, you know, I was in India at the time, and I saw the website, and I thought, that's my idea. And he went and sold it to them. That means, I mean, I was pissed off, of course, but also that's my idea, which made it into the New York Times, which means I can do this.
Yes.
And so I started pitching them myself, my own ideas, and it worked.
And something that I will put links to any websites we mention in the show notes, but something I would strongly recommend if you are a writer who's interested in that kind of media work journalism is to sign up to Mridu's email list, because she will send you like an ebook of, I think it's 21 pitch emails that worked for her. And I read through this, and I do some of this kind of work, and I found it really, a lot of people find pitching quite intimidating. They're not quite sure if they're doing it right or how to go about it. It's certainly not my favourite part of the job, but it's something I do because you have to. But what I found reading through the letters in this ebook was partly reassuring that, okay, I'm doing this right, because I use that kind of approach, but also some really nice new ideas that I hadn't considered. Just a slightly different angle to take maybe when making an approach. And so, yeah, I would highly recommend, if you're interested in writing for magazines, newspapers, that kind of thing, signing up to her email list to get a copy of that.
You know, the thing I hear from a lot of people is when they see that ebook and when they look at the pitches that I've sent, a lot of them feel this is so doable. This is not, you know, something that's completely out of this world. I could have written that. A lot of people email me to say that's so reassuring because I could have written those pitches. They're not that hard.
Yeah.
And it's not that my pitches for the New York Times were anything special, really. A couple of them even had typos in them.
Yeah.
It's just, it's the idea. I've always said it's the idea. If you have a good idea, the pitch pretty much writes itself.
Yeah.
And coming up with the good idea is sometimes the hardest bit, because it's not just the idea, but how to angle it so that it, you know, fits into the publication's style and their voice and what they really care about, what the audience of that publication cares about. So that can take a little bit of time to get used to. But, you know, the pitch itself and the writing is just, it's not that hard. Anybody can do it. And that's why I put together that ebook, to show that, you know, if you can put together two paragraphs, you can put together a pitch that sells.
Definitely. Because, I will often have an idea and I think, oh, there's a story there. And then the next stage is to kind of mentally go through a list of publications and think, does it suit this place? And then I might think, well, it could suit that place if I took that approach. Or does it suit this place? No, it's not really their kind of thing. You have to think a bit more than just having an idea and then sending it without considering the publication you're approaching.
And a good tip for that is to just think up a headline for that publication. So if you're writing it for, let's say, the New York Times, the headline would be very different from if you were writing it for the Huffington Post. So, you know, not that the Huffington Post pays, but you get my point. And once you do that, if you can sum up your idea in those 5 or 6 words of a headline, then you have narrowed it down to a point where it's actually an idea rather than just a subject. And that's the most important bit, I think.
Yes, definitely. Editors want you to do some of the work. They want to see what you'll do with something before they can see whether they think it's a fit.
Absolutely.
And so something you touched upon there, which is what we're going to focus on a bit more now, is this thing, especially nowadays, where writers in India have been pigeonholed into the kind of mass freelancing websites. We'll write 500 words for $2. Indian writers can't possibly write well. They're the ones you go to when you need something quick that doesn't really matter. And that's an incredibly difficult kind of stereotype to break through, I would imagine.
Yes, and I think it has huge disadvantages, but at the same time, that can lead to huge advantages, because when you're able to break out of there, when you're able to prove that you're not the, you know, $2 an article type of writer, editors value you so much more because, you know, I mean, it's a generalization, but at the heart of it, there is some truth to it, because there are people writing for $2 an article, and there are people in all countries who are terrible writers, and we see them all the time. Yeah. And it's not just the Indians who are writing $2 an article. Yeah. I've seen Americans do it. I've seen Brits do it. You know, I don't know how they do it, but, you know, maybe it's a hobby for them. But there are people doing it, and a lot of them are absolutely terrible. And so editors, when they're trying to wade through the, you know, pitches and the people who are emailing them, or when they send out, say, a jobs ad and the responses they receive, there's a lot of, you know, really bad stuff coming through. So if you're able to then stand out, and if you're able to impress an editor, and if you're able to make yourself seen beyond all the crap that surrounds you, I think you make it really easy to get further work. You make it really easy for an editor to trust you. And so once you're, it's hard to get beyond that, but when you do, everything becomes easier.
Yes. If you can prove yourself to be different to the negative things they may expect, and not only just prove to not be negative, that's quite a negative approach, but prove to be highly capable, highly skilled, and a very good writer, then you stand more, I would imagine.
I wouldn't recommend that you stay average, but because there are so many terrible writers coming from India, when editors do see a good writer, not even a great writer, when they see a good writer coming through from that region and they need India-specific content, you're going to stand out anyway, which is why I think there's a huge advantage there, that because of the terrible reputation, even doing an average job actually, you know, makes you stand out. I think you should do a stellar job. I don't think you should stay average, because, you know, it's going to hurt your income if you do. But it's not hard to get away from that. And once you do, because you've now sort of become a specialty, because that's become your specialty and you've proven yourself, it can really lead to rewarding work.
Yeah, yeah. And this is generally the topic that we are going to look at in more depth for the rest of this episode. And that is about turning something that could be perceived to be a disadvantage, or that could be experienced as a disadvantage, actually into a strength, into a positive. And as we've looked at there, Mridu's experience is of freelancing in India. And I have a similar but different experience, in that I'm disabled. And I spent a long time keeping that hidden because of the fear that if clients or editors knew, they may then make negative assumptions about my capabilities or my reliability or something like that. I wouldn't have ever lied about it, but I was quite happy to keep it under wraps. And what's actually happened in a process through which I decided to be more open about it is that being more open has led, I'm sure it has led to the odd client or editors, you know, making negative assumptions and backing off. But equally, it's led to me getting more work specifically because I have these experiences that others don't have.
And you know, the other thing is that if somebody is not going to work with you because of the disability or because you're in India, well, that actually saves you a lot of hassle as well, because, you know, I mean, you don't want to work with this client. At some point, you know, they're going to find out that you're in India. You can hide it as long as you like. And I know some people do. But, you know,
I'm
when
sure,
it comes time
yeah.
for payments, or when it comes time, you know, to have a conversation over the phone, you know, I mean, you can hide it. But I don't see a point, because eventually you want to work with people who are going to, who not only don't care about where you're from or the disabilities, but your ideal clients are going to be people who embrace those things and actually make use of them. So it's actually better for you if you can find out early on that a person has these issues, because then you're saved a bad client. Because these people always end up bad clients. If somebody doesn't like that you're in India, they are not the right fit for you. And if you happen to be in India, then they're not the right fit for you. And so it's better to know that early on, before you've done a whole lot of work for them, because that relationship in the end is not going to work out in the long term.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. If somebody's the kind of person who would genuinely not give work to you based on a situation like this,
no,
they're not a good person to be working with.
I mean,
on
and this
any
is especially
level.
True for you know, your situation with the disability, for instance, because if a person has a problem, you know, working with you as a writer because of a disability, then they're just not somebody you want as a client. Because if, you know, if that's the kind of value system they have, then they're, you know, not the right fit for you, in because they're, what other values are you going to not clash on and not get on with?
Definitely, that's so true. The first time I really came out about it in work, like, it's never been hidden, and I have, in some kind of opinion pieces and stuff I've written, I have referred to it or talked about it, but I had generally kept it quite separate. And then the thing that prompted me to begin being more open was I found myself on a list of the 100 most influential disabled people in Britain. And I was really kind of amused and stunned and quite pleased in a weird way. It was a very odd thing to find myself on. But I thought, actually, this is something I should mention on LinkedIn and on my professional Twitter account, and because it sounds good and we all need to share things that make us sound good. But I was also like, well, it kind of makes me sound good, but it involves being, you know, being an influential disabled person involves being a disabled person. And will it have a negative or a positive? But I thought, sod it, basically, this is quite impressive. And I mentioned it, and a few clients, you know, congratulated me, and that was all fine. But it was that made me start thinking, actually, I'm not comfortable with actively hiding this. Like, it won't often come up in conversation. You know, I often deal with people on the phone or on Skype rather than face-to-face meetings, because the internet enables me to have clients everywhere. So people don't have to know, but I'm uncomfortable with myself if I feel like I'm hiding it. That doesn't seem
And that's a really good point, because a lot of the business we do now is online. I am currently in London, so I've had the chance to meet a few of my editors. But for the last 10 years, 12 years, I've really only done work over email and Skype now, and over the phone. I've not really had the chance to meet a lot of my editors, because most of them are in the UK or the US. And I never actually did a lot of work in India. I did a few things. I worked for a couple of women's magazines, freelanced for a couple of women's magazines. But most of my clients are in the US and the UK. And so there was no reason for them to see me or have to meet me. And so, like in your circumstance, there's actually no way that it makes a difference to them in any way. And so, you know, that's one of the things to keep in mind as well, that a lot of the business we're doing now is online, and it helps to talk about these things, because they don't actually make a real, I mean, if you were going into work every day, or if they had, you know, they had to have you doing some heavy lifting, yes, maybe it makes a difference, but not if you're writing.
Yeah, and I think it's expected now that even if you're local to publications you're writing for, you still don't tend to, as a freelancer, go into the office and do any work
People
there.
don't have time. They, even if you're
It's
local,
not
they
really how
don't,
it
they'd
works
rather
these
just
days.
deal with you online, especially, you know, and they might take you out to coffee or get to know you as a person. But when it comes to work, a lot of it is just, let's just get this done and out of the way. And there's no need for us to have 10,000 meetings in order to do it.
Yeah, and you can be anywhere as long as you can have access to the people you need to interview or the information you need to get. And let's be honest, a lot of that is done online. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where you are unless you're dealing with problematic attitudes more than anything else. And so, with the work you've done for US, UK magazines, the assignments you've landed, do they tend, have they tended to be stories about things that are happening in India?
Yes and no. So I used to, because I mean, as a freelancer, you want as many clients as you can. So I started out being a generalist in terms of I'd write, you know, about anything. And when I started, like I said, I was a student and I was studying engineering. So I used to write for a lot of computer magazines and a lot of tech pubs because it just gave me an easy in. And I used to, I'd write about anything. And so in my first few years, I'd write about anything. And then that's when I started, and that was also the time when I was kind of hiding the fact that I was in India because I always thought it would be, you know, I mean, it would work against me. So, but at some point, I wanted to write about India and I, you know, I wanted to grow my business further because I was kind of stuck in the $100 to $300 range. And I started just, you know, telling editors that, you know, I'd be open to India stories. And then I, you know, had this desire to work for the New York Times and Time and publications like that. And I noticed that it was going to be easier for me to pitch them India-specific stories than it would be for me to pitch them general health stories or stories based out of the US because I wasn't there. And I started doing that. And immediately I saw an uptick in my business is because there weren't that many freelancers in India that the editors could trust or that they knew even at the time. I mean, there's it's changed now. I think there are a lot more now than they were back in the day. And back in the day, I mean, like 5, 6 years ago. But it was really hard for editors to find freelancers in India because mostly until that point, until the whole news industry kind of went boom, you know, they had foreign correspondents, they had foreign bureaus, and they had foreign correspondents. And so it was around that time that I started seeing that a lot of these expat journalists who came to India as freelancers, you know, they just kind of networked with the foreign bureaus and they got work that way. And I was never very good at networking, but I started pitching these people over email. And I found that there was a huge response because there weren't that many good journalists that they could trust. And I started making India my specialty. So first I started with, like, you know, news publications and things like that. And then I thought, well, you know, trade magazines, especially the international ones, they always need content from India and places like this. But all the expats or the journalists in India who are doing freelancing, they want to go for the, you know, the sexy newspapers, they want to go for the New York Times and the Time, but nobody's looking at the, you know, the engineering trade journal type thing. And I thought, well, that's a great opportunity because if I kind of start pitching them, I'm probably going to be their only India freelancer. And that actually was true because a lot of them had never heard from people in India or before. And so I started working for a lot of trades, and the trades actually pay a lot better than the consumer publications. They, again, this is something that's changing. But back then, or even 2 or 3 years ago, they were paying at least $1 a word. And this is changing now. I've seen rates that are much, much lower. But there are still loads of trades, trade publications that need content. And if they've got international in the title, which a lot of them do, you're in. You know, especially because there's no competition there. There's absolutely no competition there. And when I go to a trade publication and say I've written for all these nice consumer publications, they're so eager to have me on board because now they've got a proper journalist who's also keen on writing about this subject that matters to them. And that's such a rare combination. They don't find that.
Yeah, definitely. And in this blog post you wrote about turning disadvantages into strengths, it's a 5-point kind of action plan. And the first one is make your disadvantage your niche. And that's kind of what you were just talking about, that if you can stop saying, like hiding the India thing,
yeah,
and pretending it's not happening, then you can actually become the India specialist.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so for Grocers Weekly or whatever international, who, like you say, don't have an India correspondent who's based there, if something important happens, you want to be the go-to person. You want them to say, oh, we've worked with a woman in India. Let's look her up, see.
Yeah, there's another thing to this as well, which is that, you know, I was in touch with this local publication, Seattle Business something. And, you know, Seattle is home to Amazon, it's home to Starbucks, you know, all these Microsoft, all these big companies. And these companies are everywhere. They're in India. So if I can find India-specific stories about these companies, I can sell them to a publication in Seattle, which I did. And so, you know, if you just start thinking about your specialization in that way, whatever it is, it could be India, it could be disability, you just start seeing patterns everywhere. You can start putting that specialty into pretty much every publication. I've sold India-related stories to publications like Brain World, you know, because you can just find that angle anywhere. I mean, it could be a profile. It could be, you know, it's so many different things. Take your disability example, for instance. You could sell a story to Brain World that maybe finds some connection with treating disability through going into the brain or whatever. I don't know. I mean, but there are so many things that, you know, you can just start joining the dots and make your specialty or your weakness or whatever it is at the center, and then start, you know, sort of expanding from there, which is what I did. I would just go in and see every publication and then try to find ideas from the India specific angle, because that I could sell, and that is something nobody else could do.
Yeah.
And so that, and then once you're in, you can pitch other ideas as well. Once you know an editor, there's no reason you couldn't. But I found that it was easier for me to come up with ideas in this way as well, because once I had that little focal point from which to start, it just made coming up with ideas easier. And it made doing the assignments easier, because now I'm a specialist. I don't have to work too hard to get the stories, to get the information, because I know what I'm talking about, and it builds on itself.
Yeah, and the person you might be interviewing is the guy that works in the Starbucks down the road rather than the guy that works in Starbucks in Seattle.
Well, quite. I mean, but again, I'd probably just call him anyway, you know. I don't like leaving my house a lot, you know.
We're freelancers.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you think I became a freelancer? So, yeah.
The next point in your post is to turn it into an unfair advantage. Now, the idea of an unfair advantage is something I first thought about after reading something by, do you know a guy called Pat Flynn?
I do. I love Pat Flynn.
Yes, I do as well. He, for anyone who doesn't know, he has a blog called Smart Passive Income. And he is all about passive income, but not in that kind of spammy internet marketery way. Pat Flynn is a lot more about doing something a bit more substantial, something that you actually care a bit about, and he's a pretty smart guy, he's a pretty sound guy. I used to follow his blog and podcast religiously. I've backed off a bit now just because of other priorities, but he's a very smart guy to listen to, I think. And this idea of taking advantage of your unfair advantages is one that I first heard of from him. I don't know whether it was a post or a podcast episode or what, but it's an interesting one, and one that I initially struggled a bit with, in that I focused a bit too much on the unfair side of it, and I didn't want to, like, I don't know, I didn't want to be unfair. But it's actually very sound advice.
But if you think about it, we all have an unfair advantage in some way or the other. Some people are better looking, some people are better at talking, some people give really good speeches. So we do have those unfair advantages, whether or not we actually realize them. So it's just a matter of actually figuring out, what is my unfair advantage, what am I good at, and where can I use it?
Yeah, I know one that I end up using is people who I know. You know, if you need to interview somebody for a magazine feature or something, and you can't quite find the right person, but you know someone who would be great or who knows someone. That's the kind of situation where, as long as you're not exploiting people, as long as you're not doing anything unreasonable, then actually looking at your contacts or your network can really give you a boost.
Yeah. And the other thing is that you can make your disadvantage your unfair advantage. And but what I mean by that is that if you feel that there's something holding you back, if you can find a way to turn it around and think of it as something that you can use. Let me give you an example. By definition, the disadvantage puts you in a minority. So, which means that if you, and I did this for my disadvantage, which was back then being in India. And I thought, well, why don't I just use this to put it on my website and for my SEO? And I didn't really actively do much except that I put Delhi, India in the SEO of my website. And within months, I suppose it had, weeks maybe, it had shot up to the number one position on Google. So if you, it's not the case anymore because, you know, I talked about it a lot and now people have gotten a bit savvy. So they've kind of kicked me off my number one position. But for a long time, if you searched for freelance journalist India, I was the number one result. And if you searched for freelance journalist New Delhi, I was the number one result. And that led to people from Us Weekly, people from Marie Claire, people from Cosmo editors email me and offer me assignments because they would need something India specific, and they would go online and they would search for freelance journalist in India, and my name would pop up and they'd like my website and they'd get in touch. And so basically, if you can find a way to take that disadvantage, and that became my unfair advantage, is that I was number one on Google search results. And it was something that worked for me because I just knew how to play the SEO game, I suppose. And that was my unfair advantage. And yes, it's a bit unfair because there are probably people who are better suited to that work, but the editors couldn't be bothered to look further than the first or second result. And that is a bit unfair. But that is what I mean by just finding your disadvantage and then making it something that works for you.
Yeah, similarly, I've had a couple of new clients recently who have a disability-related company or sell disability related products or services or something like that, and they want, say, some blog posts for their website, which is fine, and but who had the self-awareness to say, actually, we're not that keen on having non-disabled people write about disability stuff as if they know what they're talking about, when we know that you already know a lot of the issues, you know what people are talking about, you know what people care about. And so we'd feel much happier having a disabled person write these posts. Would you be interested? It wasn't like we only want you because you're disabled. It was like, we want you because we know you're a good writer, we've read your stuff, we know you've got a good social presence, all of those things. And the fact that you're disabled kind of clinches the deal, really.
Because you know what you're talking about. Because you're a specialist. So, that's exactly right. So if you can turn that whatever weakness into a specialty, then people come to you because of it. It becomes something that you know a lot about, and that people can use that kind of information for whatever projects they're doing.
And that ties in very closely to point number three in your post, which is, to identify scenarios in business in which to use your weaknesses as an advantage. And I guess that's maybe taking it a step further, because whereas with those recent approaches I was just talking about, that was people who contacted me, you could equally, approach businesses yourself and frame the disadvantage as an advantage in that way as well.
Yeah, I suppose just start talking about it, to start telling people. So I get a lot of email from people all over the world who say, do you think I should mention it in my pitch that I'm based here or there, or should I just not say anything and just kind of hope that they don't ask? And I always say, well, you know what, just, it depends on what you're pitching. So if you're pitching a story about, I don't know, 10 ways to lose weight, probably doesn't matter. But if you're But if you're looking for work that kind of might have a significance to where you are or the topic that you're specializing in, then I think it's always worth mentioning because you never know, an editor in the future might be looking for somebody in that very specific position and they won't even know that this person they work with is actually a perfect fit for that role.
Yeah, that they've already got someone.
Exactly. And I just think it's good business practice anyway because you want a business that's and work that's going to fulfill you and that's going to be, making you happy and that is something you care about. And you can't do that if you're constantly hiding the things that you care about. And for a lot of us, these are things that we care about, like your disability and my being in India. It was something that I was passionate about, but that I felt like I had to hide for a long time because, they would hold it against me. And look, a lot of people did. I have been offered rates for, I mean, this big American publication, let's say. They got in touch with me and offered me, a full-time job for a salary that was equivalent to what they pay their freelancers per article. It was pretty insulting. And that happens and it will happen, but you can't let that one experience, that one person hold you back from all the other wonderful people who are going to reward you for that specialty or disadvantage.
And I think as a freelancer, you have to get used to the fact that a lot of people say no anyway.
Yes.
You're not going to get every pitch you send off. You're not going to get work from every company you approach, and you know that's the case from early on. And so this, sure, it adds an element to it, and it adds an element that can be maybe a bit more personal to it. But you were never going to get all the work you approached people for anyway. That's not how it works.
Yeah, and I think this goes back to one of the questions you asked me, which was whether I wrote only about India or did I also include other topics? And I think it is wise to include other topics as well because you are not your specialty, you are not your location, your disability, your whatever circumstance you are in. But you can use that without it be taking over your whole career. But you can still use it to your advantage, and it doesn't have to remain that little thing that you don't talk about that's a secret while you're doing your other work as well. So I do now branch out into a lot of other things that include science and environment and all sorts of things. But like I said, again, I always find that the India thing sort of helps me break in because I'm a specialist, and then I can write about whatever I want. But the India thing helps me break in because it's something only I can do. Well, not only I can do, I mean, I'm sure there are lots of people who can do it just as brilliantly or even better. But when I'm pitching that editor, I'm pitching something very specific and they can't hand it off to their staff.
And as you like, in the days when I was hiding it a lot more, there was not only a sense that I wasn't being very authentic with myself. There was also a kind of ongoing anxiety about what if one of my regular clients finds out and doesn't like it. Whereas once I was more open, it's not that I mention it in every contact I have. I do a lot of writing that's specialized in SEO, social media type topics. And so if I'm pitching something about that, I don't go, "Let me write about the latest changes to Facebook. By the way, I'm disabled." That's not necessary. But equally, I feel confident that if I'm pitching a story about how the latest changes to Facebook affect disabled people, then it's something I can mention as a positive.
In my post, I mention C. Hope Clark, who is the editor of fundsforwriters.com. And I like to use her example because it's one that a lot of writers are familiar with. It's this feeling of being shy and not being good networkers and not, wanting to go out into networking events because we all feel like we're better off in our caves. But she, again, understood this and she was a shy writer herself. So she wrote a book about it. She wrote How to Be a Successful Writer. Despite being shy, and her book is called The Shy Writer. And I think now it's called The Shy Writer Reborn because it's the second edition. But so she took that disadvantage that she had, and she wrote a whole book about it. And now she uses it to go out into the world, do networking, give speeches, all of that stuff. And so, again, it's not just, you know, it can be any disadvantage that you have that can be turned into an advantage. It doesn't, it's not, we're not talking specifically about location. We're talking any disadvantage. If you can just have the right mindset to it and figure out, I think you do need to sit down and think about a strategy. But if you can just think about, you know, how could I use this to my advantage? Then you really can come up with some really great ideas, and which help you stand ahead of your competition as well, because a lot of people don't do it. A lot of people think, okay, that's my weakness, so I'm going to ignore that and I'm going to focus on my strengths.
Yeah.
And if you can instead say, okay, that's my weakness and I'm going to find a way to use it, then you can really stand out from the crowd.
I read a brilliant article last night, and I will link to that book and this article in the show notes. It was called something like Marketing for Introverts, and there was one idea in it that I just thought was brilliant, and that was that you should schedule bravery.
I like that.
You should just kind of book in some bravery time into your week and use that time to send out pitches or approach or whatever it is that you yourself fear. And I just really love that concept of scheduling bravery.
Yeah.
Because it feels more manageable if you go, okay, I'm being brave from 2 till 4.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got to become a complete extrovert now.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to change who you are, but if you can use parts of, you know, the parts that you don't like and just use them every now and again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the next point in the post, again, it ties in a lot with what we've been saying. And that is to reframe the problem and give it context. So something that you mentioned that is a really, really good point here is that if you're thinking that being an international writer keeps you away from the networking events, another way to think of it is that it puts you smack bang in the middle of events that your editors don't have access to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really good point. Sure, you can't get to the New York journalist meeting, but that also means that the New York journalists can't get to New Delhi for whatever's happening there.
Exactly. They used to be able to, but now with, you know, budgets being cut, they don't have the money to. So that makes it easy as well. The thing is that even when back in the day when they used to send journalists to Delhi to cover a big event, these were people who arrived with not a lot of information. And this is, again, going back to the point of making it your specialty, because you know things that they don't. So you know what's happening on the ground. You've been there before and after. Whereas
where to go to find the right people.
Exactly.
How to approach people. You know, you've got language. A lot of journalists way back who would be sent to somewhere would be there with an interpreter, and they wouldn't quite know.
And that's an extra cost too, the interpreter and a fixer. Usually they come with two, an interpreter and a fixer, or sometimes that's one person. But, you know, they need somebody to set up the contacts. They need somebody to set up things. They need hotels. They need, you know, there's a whole lot of cost that is involved in people coming over to a country to report on it. But even if we look at it from, say, the point of view of the shy writer, for instance, you have access to... you know what it feels like to be shy. You know what it feels like to be disabled. You know things that, you know, people who are not shy or not disabled wouldn't understand. So you're able to talk to the audience in that separate, different way, a one-to-one way as well, that somebody without that would not be able to. So that actually makes you a much better writer than somebody who's not been in that position. And
so then you can pitch the How to Network When You're Shy article. Or indeed, write a book about it.
Exactly. And also then it seems true because it's coming from somebody who's been there and done that. So I would not be, I mean, I don't call myself shy. So I don't think I'd be able to write the kind of book that Hope did simply because, you know, I'm not that person. And similarly for you, you can write stuff that other people will not be able to simply because you have the personal experience to do it. And I think there's a lot to be said for personal experience, especially in writing, because you know, a lot of writing, especially these days with blogs and personal opinion and essays, does come down to knowing what you're talking about, because there are loads of people now who just kind of don't. So if you can actually come from this this place of knowing, having been there, I think it really makes a difference.
And I think it's important to point out at this stage that your disadvantage or your situation that makes you stand apart can be anything at all. It doesn't have to be as dramatic as living in India, being disabled, whatever. It can be being a twin or having three children, or, you know, people these days write from all kinds of perspectives, and that is valued. If somebody's writing about raising twins, you kind of expect that writer in many situations to have raised twins.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a disadvantage, though. You know, I mean, some people would argue that having twins is not quite a disadvantage, though I would say it is. It doesn't have to be a disadvantage. It could just be something that you experience every day, and that is something that is a part of your life. But a lot of the times, I think it helps to think of your disadvantages as well. Just as, you know, after I had my son, it became a real disadvantage, not that I had my son, but that, you know, my work hours were cut in half. And, you know, so I didn't, but I'm sure you could use that as, you know, ways to, you know, you could write about productivity, you could write about ways to earn, I did actually write about how to earn a full-time living in part-time hours. So, you know, you can find, you can take that disadvantage and you can find positives out of it and actually make it something that you write about and become an expert in.
Absolutely. And often, if you write about something from a point of view that is even slightly unusual, you will then be approached by other companies or publications who also want something from that point of view. I know that's been my experience. There was one topic I wrote about, and I'm still regularly approached to write about that same topic because they say, oh, I saw you wrote about this, we want something on that. Mm-hmm. Would you write about it for us from a different perspective? And so sometimes just writing one or two things from a perspective that's a bit out of the ordinary can open the door for a wide range of work.
Yep, absolutely.
And the final point in the post kind of brings together everything we've been saying, which is embrace your situation, don't hide from it. Both of us have talked about how early on we tried to kind of brush under the carpet this kind of potential disadvantage that could result in us losing work or not being taken seriously, and then how we began to embrace it, we began to be more open about it, and were able to turn it into a positive, into something that made us exactly the right person to write about something.
I think you and I were both kind of forced into it in some ways, and I think that is the way it happens with a lot of people.
Yeah.
But if you can do it proactively, if you can just sit down today after listening to this episode and think about what are the things that you feel are holding you back, then you can save yourself that time. I could have saved myself 3 years, and I think I would have just gotten that work quicker. And I mean, I'm glad for the experience, but sure, of course, if I could save 3 years and get to that point earlier, why not? So if you can sit down after this episode and think about what is it that you feel holds you back and maybe think about ways in which you can use that, you save yourself the angst as well. You save yourself time and you save yourself some angst.
Yeah. And in embracing your situation, you need to also think about how you present your situation to others. Because often the way you present something dictates how the person you're talking to reacts. So if you talk about it apologetically or a bit embarrassed or a bit like, I'm sorry, but, then you might have a negative reaction. Whereas if you present it as something relevant, positive, useful, unique, then the person you're dealing with might well see it that way as well.
That's so true. That's a very good point, because if you can go in there and say, look how great it is that I am here and I can do this for you and this is my specialty, aren't you so glad you found a person who can, you know, who gets it, then they will see it that way as well. If you go in apologizing, oh, I'm sorry, but I just happen to be in India, would it be a problem if you could just send my money via PayPal? Well, then, you know, then they're going to get that sense as well. And then, you know, they're not going to think of it as an advantage. Then they are going to think, oh, well, what a bother.
Yeah.
So I think it really goes, it helps, even if you have to fake it at the beginning, to just say, well, look how cool it is that I'm here, or this is who I am. And, you know, other people have, you know, really liked that I make this my specialty, and I'm sure you will too.
Yeah. And I think, a lot, in my experience at least, a lot of freelancing is faking it. A lot of it is presenting a really positive view of yourself when you might be cringing inside.
Mm-hmm.
But you just have to be ultra positive, and this is another of those situations where, like Mudu said, you can't say, I want to write this for you, I'm really sorry I am in India, but I can still do a really good job.
Yeah. Sorry, my English isn't too good, but yeah,
that's
no.
Never gonna work.
Yeah. Sorry, it's my second language. But I can do a good job for you. Yeah, no, you need to if you're going to use your disadvantage and think of it as something that can be helpful for your career, then you need to think of it as a strength. I think it's a mindset shift, and once that mindset shift happens, then everything changes.
Yeah, I went to an event a few months ago where it was about disability and self-employment. And there was a guy, young guy, who did a speech all about how you should be very open about your impairment in your work. You should never, ever, ever hide it. And I remember thinking at the time, well, yeah, but he's saying that in the context of being a person whose job is to give motivational type speeches about kind of making it against the odds
and
being successful despite being disabled. And so his whole career is based on that. Whereas most people aren't in that position where their entire workload depends on people knowing they're disabled. However, there's a balance. You don't have to put it at the forefront of everything. But if you can shift your own mindset about it, see it as something useful, unique, interesting, helpful, then that will also shift other people's understandings of it as well.
Yeah, you know, one last point that I'll add, which I hadn't thought of before, is that you can use it as something that helps you actually become personable with people. For instance, after telling editors that I'm in India, I've had so many of them email me back and say, oh, I've always wanted to go there, or I was there, you know, 5 years ago, or I lived there, and you could find the same for a lot of other specialties and a lot of other disadvantages, so to speak. You might say to somebody, okay, I have this condition or this, you know, this disability, and they might say, oh, you know what, my brother has it too, and it might be something that you can talk about that makes you a real person and somebody that they can identify with. And I had so many editors saying, oh, well, you know, we must catch up next time I'm in India or something like that. And it didn't always happen. But, you know, it gave us a talking point. It gave us something to connect and bond over. And I think that's another thing that you can you should consider, is that you could use something, you know, like that to bond with people. And one last example is that because I lived in India, I lived on a busy street. It was always noisy when the editors called me. There were dogs barking and, you know, cars honking all the time. It was, you know, it was quite embarrassing at times, because I'd be talking to the editor and there'd be like this dog going mad on the road over. And I just learned to laugh at it and make a joke of it instead of being like, oh, I'm so sorry, and being all professional about it. I'd just laugh and I'd say, huh, India, huh? And and they would laugh with me, and it would become something that we could laugh over instead of me feeling like I hadn't been professional, or, you know. Because there was one time when I was talking to an editor, and my landlady, who used to live upstairs, she came knocking on the door and yelling, and I couldn't open the door because I was on a phone call. Yeah. And India being India, she just started yelling outside my door. And so I had to just apologize to this editor and say, you know, hey, what can I do? This is where I live. And she was fine. She laughed with me and she was like, why don't I call you back in 5 minutes? And that was done. It wasn't something that I had to, you know, be embarrassed over. And I know that 10 years ago when I was a new freelancer, that would be something that would have just terrified me.
Yes. Yes. And you'd have obsessed about it afterwards.
For years. Yeah, she's never going to work with me again. But it wasn't a big deal. And I think a lot of these things are not a big deal for the right people. There will be people who hold it against you.
Yes.
But for the right people, the right clients, they won't care. In fact, they might actually appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I remember that's just reminded me ages ago, I was talking to a potential new client on the phone. It was quite an important call. There was quite a lot of work at stake. And I knew that at some point between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m., the gas man was going to come. And I knew without question that he would arrive while I was on this call, for the 20 minutes I was on this call. I just thought, that's how it's bound to work, because it's an important call and I need him not to. And sure enough, I was just rounding up the call with this woman and the bell went, and I just made a joke of it. I said, you know, I knew that of the 10 hours he could have come, I knew it would be when I was on the phone to you. And she laughed. It was fine. She knows I work from home. You know, these things happen.
Yeah. And everybody understands.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I think, listeners, have a think about, even if you don't have something that could immediately necessarily be perceived as a disadvantage as such, trying to consider whether there are things that could just make you stand out, could make you feel unique, could give you a perspective that not many other people have, and see whether there are ways you can use that in your work. It's a really interesting idea, and it's one that there's a lot of freelance writers nowadays, and you do need something to allow you to step up a bit.
Yep.
And so, if people want to contact you, I will put all the links and things in the show notes. But if you want to mention maybe your Twitter ID, your website, or wherever, if anybody wants to check out what you're doing, where would they find you?
I think the easiest way to find me now is just go to theinternationalfreelancer.com, and there are links to everything on there. And you'll also find this blog post that we've been talking about, as well as several others. This is just a new website that I've just started. It will also take you back to my own portfolio website, which is mridhukulur.com, which is harder to find. So just go to theinternationalfreelancer.com and you will get the links to everywhere.
Yes, Ruby and I have had many conversations about trying to find a website address when nobody can spell your name.
Yes.
It's a tricky one, and she's bound hairs. I'm not quite there yet. Yes. And I'll link directly to that blog post, but I would recommend reading the other posts on her site. I really enjoyed them, but they're really useful and great, frankly.
Thank you.
And so thank you so much for agreeing to have this conversation. It's been really interesting. It's given me a lot of new ideas, and hopefully other people will find the same.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And so I hope you really enjoyed that. Mridhu is such an interesting woman and she's done so much. She's really, really great. So I definitely recommend checking out her website, following her on Twitter, all of that stuff. And all of the links we mentioned will be in the show notes at alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com. On that page, you can also find links to our social media feeds, my own websites, The Little Bird Told Me Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/freelancewritingpodcast. And now it's time for a quick Little Bird recommendation of the week, in which we suggest something we think people might enjoy or find useful. And mine is from the Moz blog. Now, Moz used to be called SEO Moz. It's a very, very good site if you're into SEO, content marketing, any of that kind of thing. And it's a blog post called, "But How Do I Know If It's Good? How You Can Evaluate Content Quality and Ditch Content Anxiety." Now, it's a great post. It's very detailed, loads and loads of examples, and it can help you evaluate your own work. It can help you evaluate other people's work if you're doing some editing, or if you're starting to do some work with a new company who've previously had another content provider, anything like that. So it's a great post. The link will be in the show notes. And with that, thank you very much for listening. I have been Philippa Willits, and we will see you next time.